And in this case, Mr. Becker, you are the appellant, so you may proceed on this second case of the day.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case is substantially similar to the Farm Bureau case. There are a couple of distinguishing factors, but at its heart, the question is, did we state a cognizable claim upon which relief may be granted? And I respectfully submit that, again, with respect to this case, under the Tryon standard, because we're not pleading fraud, we're pleading breach of contract and bad faith.
And you're pleading assignment.
Yes, and we've averred that there's an assignment. There doesn't have to be any magic averment as to the nature of the assignment. If that's the case, then that will fundamentally change the nature of allegations in cases filed every day in courts throughout this state, because people will come in and say, attach a copy of your assignment to every credit bureau that is seeking relief, to everyone that's pursuing recovery on an assigned claim for some physician proceeds. If you examine those complaints, as I see them every day, and I'm sure they occasionally make their way up here, they're usually bare bones pleadings, 2, 3, 4 paragraphs, nowhere near the details of the averments in this complaint. And if I went into county court and said, Judge, I want the assignment from the credit card company, and I want them to detail the consideration, I want to know the date of the assignment, and all sorts of details, I would get laughed out of court. They would say, Mr. Becker, go do that in discovery. That's the purpose of discovery. You've been given enough allegations. They've asserted they're an assignee. They assert that you are that they're owed this money because they're assignee, and they say your client owes it. That is essentially what we're saying in this case. And these allegations.
Counsel, before your time runs out again, I'd like to ask you about the bad faith claim. Is that assignable?
Yes.
Why?
It arises out of, in Brace, this court said it arises out of the contract, the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Under the statutes, there's a continuing duty of the insurance company to process these claims in good faith. They have to timely respond to communication. They have to pay with prompt payments, or they have to pay with promptness. They have to develop procedures to investigate the claims. In this case, we gave further allegations that there was delays in payment, that they failed to respond in a timely manner to communication. Essentially, when they had notice of the assignment, which this court recognized was valid in the original Miller Gutter versus Farm Bureau case, they ignored it. They just said, we're not paying you. We don't recognize that. Even though there's a case and there's statutory framework established recognizing the validity of the assignments, these insurance companies continue to thumb their nose and say, we're not dealing with you.
Do you have to show any distinct harm beyond just the failure to pay the claim?
In this case, among other things, we've alleged delay and attorney fees. And that's one of the reasons why attorney fees would be independently recoverable under bad faith, because what invariably happens in these cases is they'll litigate these things for 2 and 3 years, hold on to the money, and then at the end, they will confess judgment for the balance of the contract without attorney fees. So you may have a claim for $49,000. They'll confess judgment for $50,000, and under the framework of the statutes, you can't get attorney fees because you're capped at that $49,000. You won't get a judgment in excess of that, and thereby, if you've incurred $20,000 of attorney fees, you're out of luck under the statutory framework. The bad faith argument gives us an ability to say, hey, you've caused us to incur damages by virtue of the continued retention of the money.
Caused Miller Gutter to incur additional damages, or caused the policyholder to incur additional damages?
Both, to the extent that the policyholder was entitled to have its claim paid with promptness. Miller Gutter, with respect to the fact that they were damaged by virtue of not receiving payment or timely communication, and they incur expense in that process.
So this court hasn't yet analyzed whether bad faith claims, whether they be first party bad faith claims or third party bad faith claims, are assignable. And if so, under what circumstances? Would you like to weigh in on what you think the rules should be in that regard? What principles you think should govern our analysis in that regard?
As I said before the district court, That's something that should be, and as Tryon recognizes, that's something that should be adjudicated on a full record.
I'm asking you what principles you think we should apply, not whether you pled sufficiently a first party bad faith claim. You're in front of the court that need, that's going to make the decision. What principles do you think should apply to the question of whether a first party bad faith claim is assignable? And if so, under what circumstances?
Embrace this, that this court said that tort arises out of the obligations under the contract. In this case, that insurance contract carries with the other obligations as mandated by the Claims Practices Act statute. When you have a party that's been assigned the rights under the, under the policy, which is to receive the cost of the repairs made to return the property to its pre-storm condition, the party that is damaged is the party that stands in the shoes. Some insureds hold that right because they don't make an assignment, and they may be delayed 2 and 3 years because the insurance company fails to pay them for things like ice and water shield, sheathing, decking, etc. But when the when the insured has,
I'm going to interrupt you, sir. I apologize for that, but I still don't have an answer to which legal principles you think should govern the question of whether a first party bad faith claim is assignable. Is it our tort jurisprudence? Under tort, we have said a tort claim can, the proceeds can be assigned, but control of the action cannot. Why wouldn't that rule apply to the tort of first party bad faith?
Because it arises under the contract. Embrace, they said, the duty arises under the
continued, that's just where the tort duty comes from.
But it arises, I respectfully suggest that it arises under that continuing duty under the contract, which has with it a statutory framework that says, hey, when someone's done this work, you have to pay them promptly. You have to communicate with them.
When so it would be your position that the assignability should turn on the assignability rules that we apply in a post-loss insurance claim context.
Yes, because it arises out of contract. With respect to this particular case, there are some additional assignments of error raised, and in particular, the dismissal with prejudice when we elected to stand on our complaint. There are approximately 240 cases in Nebraska that recognize that a party can elect to stand on its complaint after a demur or a motion to make more definite is sustained. There are in excess of 40 cases where an appellate court has subsequently reversed a lower court and said, even though that party elected to stand on the complaint, it was an abuse of discretion or an error to sustain a dismissal because they adequately pled a claim, just as the Court of Appeals determined in Farm Bureau. In this case, the court dismissed the action with prejudice after we said we're electing to stand on a complaint. When there's a show cause to, if it was going to be dismissed without prejudice for lack of progression, we said, Judge, we, and there was a prior case which we appealed, but we repeated we're going on the same tack. We wish to stand on a complaint so that we can explore these issues of have we adequately pled bad faith? Do we have enough pleadings to avert contract? And in response to that, when it would, otherwise we wouldn't have shown up, just dismissed on without prejudice for failure to prosecute, the court converted it to a dismissal with prejudice because we elected to stand on our complaint. I respectfully submit that was error. Under 25601, it should have been without prejudice. And as a consequence, I submit that was an error.
Is there a harm in dismissing it with prejudice? Do we know a breach date? Do we know statute of limitations issues? The storm occurs in 2013. The complaint's filed in 2018. Dismissals in 2019. Is there harm as a result of the dismissal with prejudice?
There's potential harm, but either way, because in terms of the breach, it's not till they hire the contractor, which is months later, and then when the insurance company denies the payment that the insured is ultimately due, and they have 2 years to complete these repairs. So you may have a breach that's occurring a year or two down the road from the date of the storm. The date of the storm is not the appropriate
measure. How long after the assignment was given did the breach occur? And is that relevant?
that can be relevant, and that's something developed through discovery. When they sit there and they get the assignment that this court's recognized as valid, which is a statute that says it's valid, and says, we're not going to talk with you. We're not going to process your claims. We're not going to pay you. Even though you've done the work to repair this home, we're not paying you a dime. We're not recognizing your rights, and we're going to ignore you. And the problem is, from the insureds, they don't have the incentive to pursue it, because in their mind, they've assigned their claim.
Do we know the date of the alleged breach from the complaint itself?
Because we allege in the aggregate, we say it's after the date of the assignment and the work has been done. Ultimately, it's when the work's completed and they fail to pay what they're obligated to pay under the policy.
So in this case, there were 6 claims. Is that right?
Yes.
Am I looking at the right one? So we don't know individually of those 6 claims when the breach was alleged to have occurred. Is that correct?
That's correct.
From the complaint?
Yes. I see that my time's out. So.
Thank you very much. Mr. Gibbons, good morning to you again.
Your Honors, may it please the court, Ray Walden for...
I'm sorry, Mr. Walden. Good morning to you again.
And as kind of indicated by this, we actually have some other insurance companies also have been dealing with roofing cases. And so we see patterns where the bad, as we discussed in the previous case, where a bad faith is alleged so that it can all get into discovery and make trouble and expense for the insurance company. Just go ahead and pay it, get rid of them. It's only a few thousand dollars, clear your books. And that actually was going on for a good while. And then some of us, our insurance companies decided, this is a huge pattern. We need to kind of look in the guts of these cases and see what's really there and should we resist them or not. But
I beg your pardon. What would you suggest from a legal framework is the minimum of what should be pled to put your clients on notice of what's afoot? What facts do you think are required to be pled?
Well, first of all, we need to know who the, if we were talking about the assigned contract claim, we need to know what the contract was. Who was it? What was the property? What was their date of loss? We've gotten, in this particular case, Shelters, there was a list of 6 names. That's it, names. And that there has been no amended complaint in this one. So that's all we have still. And so the court said, you need to give more than that. Give the assignments, give the policy numbers at least. I mean, so we can form a response. I mean, this is a definite and certain, and that's the whole purpose of that is.
So in, let me ask you then, is it the case that that your client believes it doesn't know what set of facts have occurred that could be characterized as bad faith? Don't know what happened, don't know events, don't know the dates, that kind of thing. And that's the kind of detail that you seek in a complaint? Or do you preserve your curiosity by raising all the defenses and affirmative defenses you could line up in the answer?
I think we ought to be able to have some sort of a factual basis for making defenses instead of just throwing things out there, because maybe it'll apply theoretically in cases vaguely like this. We want, on the bad faith part, we want to be able to plug in enough of the elements from Brosh to be able to say they're alleging that there was bad faith with respect to that insured before the assignment. Otherwise, it's not a bad faith claim. Let's pull that out. We can deal with the contract claim.
Counsel, which legal principles do you suggest this court should apply in considering whether a first party bad faith claim is assignable, and if so, under what circumstances?
Well, principles include that inchoate claims are not assignable. There has to be a present interest, and we cite those to that sort of authority in our brief. There's no present interest if You know, there's no allegations that the insured suffered any sort of a consequent loss from non-payment. And the idea, and here's a quote, not pay one dime or not pay you a dime. That is certainly not, there's nothing in the record about that. You know, this is, doesn't happen in any of these. The very first thing that happens is actual cash value is paid upon the claim being made on the basis of the estimate of the insurance company. Here's what it's going to take to fix it as replacement cost. We'll give you the seed money of the actual cash value, which takes out from replacement cost the amount of the depreciation, how old is the roof kind of thing. Then under the contract, if they go ahead and they replace or repair, that's when, well, we figure out, all right, were we right with our original estimate? Now we may need to revise that and pay the replacement cost. So where these kinds of cases come in is they take an assignment and they say, oh, well, we have been able to make our own estimate and we've thrown in everything that could possibly ever, have to be done when there's been a hail claim on this sort of a roof. So that's our claim. Yeah, that's our assigned claim. And then they say, oh, we stand in the shoes of the insured. So they think that they can take the, even if work isn't done, they take the money. They've been assigned the entire claim. Now, maybe the roof has been fixed. Generally, it has been, because they don't want to be getting sued by the insurance for just not doing the work at all. But very often, there is not anything else done. And you saw that in that Valley Boys case. I've had the cases where they didn't do anything on the deck whatsoever, but it's in the estimate, and that's part of the claim. And the estimate keeps going up. They keep doing more estimates. That's part of the business model for some of these roofing companies taking these kinds of assignments. And the assignments started to come in when this notion passed around, hey, we could do this way and make more money off of it than just getting paid to put a roof up. So we are indeed pushing back. It has nothing to do with not paying a dime. It has to do with paying what the claims are actually worth and not the inflated values that are being presented under these assignments.
When the district court dismissed this complaint with prejudice for failure to comply with a prior order, was that error? Should the dismissal have been without prejudice?
I don't believe so. For one thing, as I cited in our brief, there are, this court has affirmed in various cases where, the concept is you make a shot at making your claim and the court says, well, you can amend that, but that doesn't suffice what you alleged. Okay, if you make the amendment, we go on from there. And now is that sufficient? If you don't make the amendment and you stand on it, you just get to keep refiling this claim. It has been determined not sufficient. I think this court has said that can now put an end to it. It's with prejudice. Now go to the appellate court so they can say whether it really indeed it should have been dismissed in the first place.
If someone stood on their complaint and were, was dismissed without prejudice and then filed exactly the same thing, wouldn't the defendant raise an issue of res judicata or at least collateral estoppel?
Well, I believe so, yes.
So
it's the same effect.
In that instance, does it really make a difference to be able to raise that defense, whether or not it said with prejudice or without prejudice?
It can make a difference in the sense of they will go ahead and make another try with the without prejudice and maybe now put in the allegations that didn't work before. And now we've got this whole other struggle about res judicata. I think it was perfectly appropriate, has been endorsed by this court, that if they stand on the complaint, they take the consequences of having done that. Now, it took a year and 5 months to finally get around to saying, oh, yeah, by the way, we never filed anything pursuant to the court order because we're standing on the complaint.
Why is that relevant? process about whether a dismissal should be with prejudice or without?
It gets into the sanction aspect, because we did ask for the sanction of dismissal, and that was tied up in it, that there'd just been no compliance with the court order for such a long time. And finally, we get into the hearing and, oh, we stand on the complaint. Okay, let's dismiss this with prejudice. You've made your choice that you had good allegations. Now let's, go to the appellate court and find out if that was true. And I don't believe it is, and then the court should affirm the district court in the shelter case, just as in the previous case, it should affirm the district court by reversing the Court of Appeals decision. If you have any other questions, I think I have a teensy bit of time left. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Walden, do you have any time for rebuttal? There's no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments in Millard Gutter Company versus Shelter Mutual Insurance Company. So you are excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is State on behalf of Daphne F. versus Christina C.